You are tuned in to the Global Perspectives on Digital Health podcast. My name is Shubs Upadhyay, physician working in digital health. I'm keen to learn more about the issues, challenges, and successes where digital health can have a real impact for underserved communities around the world. If you're a founder, investor, donor, researcher, or are developing and implementing digital health anywhere in the world, and you're keen to break out of your bubble, join me as I speak to experts and innovators and get a truly global perspective on digital health. I'm really excited about this episode. As a clinician, I'm always keen to get to know other clinicians in the digital health space. Today, I'm thrilled to have Bilal Mateen, who's a clinician by background and he's executive director of Digital Square. And you'll find out a little bit more about what Digital Square do a bit later. But as my summary, if you want some real know-how on what it takes to bring together policy and actual impact on the ground for people, then Bilal's insights are for you. We're going to go into how to create real impact for people in villages, in rural areas, and really get into what the challenges are in bridging policy and ensuring that tracks to meaningful difference in an individual's health and life. So really, really looking forward to this one, and I hope you enjoy it. Bilal, I'm thrilled to have you as a guest on the podcast, and I'm sure our audience will have a lot to learn from your experience and insights. Could you start by telling us a little bit about yourself and the work of Digital Square?
Absolutely, Shubs. It's a pleasure to be here. I'm super excited about the conversation. We've spoken several times and gotten into it, so I'm sure we'll get into it again. But for everyone listening, my name is Bilal Mateen. I'm the executive director of Digital Square. I'm actually a medical doctor by training, but it was alongside medical school that I fell into the world of academia around informatics, machine learning for health. Spent a lot of time trying to expand my expertise around AI, the risks, the challenges, the opportunities, especially in the healthcare space. Had the pleasure of working at the Alan Turing Institute, at the Wellcome Trust, so a philanthropy, the National Institute for AI, did some really interesting projects at national level, which taught me a lot about the difficulties of scaling these technologies. And then more recently, I moved over to an initiative called Digital Square, which is hosted by PATH, a global NGO. And our job is really to expand and support the world to achieve health equity. And that's by accelerating the development of medical products, increasing access to those products, and protecting vulnerable populations like women and children. But the work of Digital Square really is to strengthen health systems through digital and data transformation. And that all really came about, I don't know if you remember, but 2014 to 2016, there was the West African Ebola outbreak. We didn't do as well as we could have. And it was in the aftermath of that outbreak that all the donor, philanthropy, multilateral implementing partner community came together and said, what could we have done better? And the through line from their reflections was, there was a fragmented digital ecosystem which undermined our response. It prevented the right data being brought together for the right people to help make action-oriented policy decisions so that we could address the outbreak and contain it. And we lost a lot more lives than we needed to as a consequence. So it was really the US government, so USAID and the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, that recognized that what we needed was this market-shaping entity to help support governments strengthen their capacity for how to design these systems, build out their digital health strategies, implementation plans for scaling national infrastructure and digital health, to really coordinate the donors at the national level so that they weren't supporting a thousand wildflowers, but were rather directing their investment towards those strategies. And then doing interesting things like figuring out how do we pay for this stuff at the global level and the national level. So that's really the work of Digital Square. I'd like to believe we've been pretty successful in the last 7 years. We've mobilized just over $150 million in capital to support. I think we've been working in across 36 countries globally. So yeah, the mission continues. We have a lot of work left to do, but step by step, I think we're getting there.
It sounds really broad, the scope of what you guys do. And one of the things I saw on your website was you talked about, the website talks about digital public goods. Can you just quickly explain what those are?
So digital public goods, open source, either software, content or services that are available to support an SDG. So in our case, SDG 3, which is about supporting healthy lives, we actually talk about a subset of DPGs, digital public goods, called the Global Goods for Health. There are so many digital public goods. You and I, in the next half an hour, if we wanted to, could write some code and say that it was to support SDG 3 and then submit it to the Digital Public Goods Alliance and get it registered. What we realize when working with governments is that they need mature digital public goods, things that have demonstrated the ability to be used in multiple contexts at national scale, meet enterprise requirements, so they've thought about cybersecurity, are interoperable, so comply with all the important standards that we care about, and have a healthy and robust community of practice that are committed to supporting their maintenance. Mm-hmm. So we whittled down through this competitive process, and we repeat it annually now. It's actually an open process, so you can submit it at any time. We whittled it down to 42 global goods for health, so that are mature, scalable digital public goods. And the idea is we're trying to address that information asymmetry that governments face, where in a lower middle income country, often when you're doing procurement, if you don't know what the field of technologies looks like, and you end up just defaulting to the last one you were told about, assuming it meets enough of your requirements. We really wanted to help governments get out of that trap of defaulting to the last thing they heard about. So created the guidebook to say, here is your menu of options. Here is what these tools often get used for and how they could be used in your context.
Very, very interesting. You mentioned information asymmetry as well. And in the last episodes, we were talking about health data poverty, which I think is another type of information asymmetry, right? I'd be interested to know, maybe this is the second part of the question, would creating, for example, one of the actions or recommendations was proactively trying to create inclusive and representative data sets. I can imagine that being a digital public good or a data set that was existing that was doing that. But do you have any thoughts or do you have a perspective, particularly with your work in Digital Square, on health data poverty and how it plays out in the context that you work in?
Absolutely. And I should mention that I think Zhao is incredible. I think the work she's done on the topic of health data poverty, especially with the Standing Together initiative, is probably one of the most prolific things that more people should know about. So thanks so much for giving her a platform to talk about it. In our context, health data poverty, I think, has much more of an emphasis on the poverty aspects. Right? We know there is a lack of representativeness in data sets globally. We know that leads to disenfranchisement of communities, of individuals, the downstream consequences that we widen the health inequality gap. I'm thinking about it daily in the context of all routine healthcare information systems end up falling victim to that issue, right? So there is a lot we can do to strengthen them, to enfranchise communities, to engage so that we have better quality information on them, so that we can develop policies that support them and reflect their needs. But like I said, we anchor a lot on the poverty aspect because many of the communities we're trying to help that are what we call at the last mile of healthcare don't have consistent access to WASH infrastructure, so water, sanitation, and hygiene infrastructure, right? They don't have access to either electrical grid connectivity or internet connectivity, right? They don't have access to core infrastructure that you and I think just take for granted. Mm-hmm. And what that means is we've got two layers of an issue. Even if we built the brilliant digital health information systems, how do we get them out to these rural underserved communities in a way that we can consistently get the information we need? And it introduces a whole bunch of challenges that we think through on the technical side, which is like, how do you build the same information system so that it can function offline? So a community health worker can go out to the community with a phone and a power bank. And the power bank is the critical bit. So they can do 3 days worth of work collecting information. And then when they come back to the city or where there's internet access, upload all of that information so that the community is now represented. So huge and very similar problems, I think probably a little bit more exacerbated in the countries that Digital Square works in, but principally really similar, just with the additional angles of what true poverty means for not just health data, but data, technology, and digital transformation at large.
Yeah, and thanks for outlining that health data poverty is kind of only one aspect or vertical of problems or issues that you deal with that are actually impacting people on the ground. And I like this term that you use, the last mile of healthcare. It feels so important. And we often work so hard to do all the bits around the deployment and the technical aspects, and kind of just reminding ourselves that it's actually this, the last mile user or the last mile of healthcare, that is the really important like effector end of this. It's so important that there's an even an organization called Last Mile Health, right? And it solidifies the importance of this concept. Do you have anything more to say on this last mile, or maybe for our metric people, the last 1.6 kilometers of healthcare?
Maybe it's useful just for me to share with you what the actual definition is so that we can all anchor on that. Mm-hmm. But in international development terms, reaching that last mile or a rural isolated community involves reaching villages, communities, individuals that wouldn't normally have access to things like paved roads, little access to communication and kind of overall poor infrastructure. And without services flowing in and out of these areas, people are disconnected from incredibly valuable products, technologies, and they're often left in a state of perpetual poverty. So it's that higher level issue of poverty of which health data is one critical access. And the difficulty in reaching them is that there are just constrained human and financial resources. To give you an example, the way the healthcare system operates across Africa is really different to how we do it in the UK, where you and I would call up our general practitioner to make an appointment with a primary healthcare physician. The front line of healthcare, or the first line of frontline healthcare in Africa, are actually community health workers. These aren't medically trained professionals. Often they have several days or a few weeks of training on how to use information systems and really basic knowledge of triage. But they have such a critical role because they're trusted members of the community, so everyone comes to them. And often they're forced to work at a much higher level of competency, right? They're forced to make really critical decisions about whether someone should be going to hospital or not, because that journey to the hospital could be several months' wage. So that's all to say that when we think about health inequalities, the reason reaching the last mile of healthcare, these last mile communities, is so important is I don't know if everyone has the context. I think I've learned never to assume that they do. When you go to a country like Kenya, Nairobi is remarkably similar to a lot of the high-income developed nations, metropolitan cities that we visit, right? It's very easy just to think of it as, oh, everyone has worse healthcare. There are some phenomenal hospitals in Nairobi. It's the inequality gap that often exists between those in Nairobi, those out in much poorer slum communities, right? So I wouldn't tar with the same brush everyone in a low or middle income country. And really, if we're going to address the inequality gap, it requires us to get out into those underserved populations.
100%. And I think Professor Alex, who was in Brazil, kind of mentioned a similar thing of we really need to think in a more nuanced way. Mm-hmm. Even if we're really thinking globally, you know, if we think about high income countries, it's a well trodden path where people have talked about how life expectancy changes across the Jubilee line in London. Right. And, you know, that plays out. I was at the OECD high level policy forum where Secretary of State for Health from the US talked quite candidly about the tragedy that is in the US, where, you know, some of the maternal health outcomes there in some parts of the US are comparable to some of the areas that you've been talking about in low and middle income countries. So this plays out in many contexts, and it's not as simple as saying, oh, in all low and middle income contexts, it's the same, and in all high income contexts, it's the same. So really getting contextual there is really important, and playing out in terms of underserved communities can be in any of those contexts. And what are we doing to proactively reach out to them? So really, really great framing there. Bilal, you've kind of gone into a little bit around the challenges. You've defined what this last mile of healthcare is and how important it is, and how the impact of a well thought out innovation can really impact people's lives in this tangible way, and that kind of decision making, and also on community health workers who are this linchpin of the community and the way healthcare is delivered. Mm-hmm. The work that you've done has enabled health systems, has enabled innovators in these contexts. Mm-hmm. Have you got some standout examples of kind of how this plays out or some positive impacts that you've seen?
Absolutely. And I think I'll, otherwise we'd be here all day with me just listing out great groups. Focus on the examples I've got in the AI space, and I'll throw in sort of large language models because it feels like no conversation about AI is complete without mentioning them. So on the, let's call it simpler machine learning side, folks have been doing great work on predicting the likelihood of people with HIV discontinuing care. Not showing up to the clinic to get the next batch of antiretrovirals that they need to suppress their disease and live a relatively normal and healthy life. And what you can do is if you can predict people who are at high likelihood of discontinuation, you can give them a longer treatment course, right? You can dispense them instead of 1 month's worth of drugs, 6 months or a year. And that means that they're more likely to keep taking their medication because it's in the house. It means they're more likely to keep their viral load suppressed. And that prevents onward transmission. It also means that they have better health outcomes. And you can do that using the routinely collected information. We know that there are really key risk factors for discontinuation, living further away from the clinic, being of a certain demographic. And so I think that's a really key and easy way to get ahead of a problem that we know continues to fuel the AIDS epidemic globally, which is discontinuation of care. You have cutting-edge research on the large language model side. So the Google Health team released a paper describing a trial they did of ARMI, which is their diagnostic dialogue system, which demonstrates that you can get superior performance in terms of collecting information from potential patients, more empathetic dialogue compared to primary care physicians from a large language model, right? Which is really interesting. Not to suggest, and I love Alan Carthy at Google Health, who's one of the senior authors on the paper, was saying this to a group of people when they went, oh, but if it's better than the physician, let's just replace the physicians, right? This is the case for autonomous diagnostic systems. And he was like, let's calm down.
Hold our horses.
Yeah, hold our horses. It's as important for the physician to be wrong, right? It's that classic adage of hear hooves, think horses, not zebras. A lot of the stuff we're testing LLMs on are the really rare cases. And often it's that cycle of going through the common differentials that means we pick up the key stuff. So I don't think we're there yet with autonomous systems, but really exciting to see that research show the prospect and the value of large language models. A slightly more realistic anchored example, I mentioned community health workers earlier. There's a company called Viamo, this Canadian NGO, that created a call center service that's backed by an LLM. So what you see amongst the community health worker community is that they all love texting each other on WhatsApp to ask each other's advice. They basically leveraged this and said, wouldn't it be cool if they could text an LLM that could access a canonical data source, whether that's the internet or all of the primary healthcare guidelines that exist, and go, I've got this patient, I think I've got this problem, what do I do next? And then the LLM can give them some advice. Like lots of work that still needs to be done on making sure this stuff is safe. But I think the early evidence around its effectiveness means that you can really support community health workers do their job better and make sure that, again, people at the last mile of healthcare are getting world-class care that kind of exceeds what you could get from putting a physician in the field, which we know is far too expensive to practically do. But there's a world in which we could get there. So I think the last one I'll give you, Shubs, if you'll allow me,
sure,
is that there are great companies like Outeray out there in the world as well that have been thinking about how we take generative AI to support self-testing workflows, right? To leverage computer vision to create a new foundation model for reading rapid diagnostic tests, which we know is a key bit of the clinical pathway you need to navigate if you're going to access antimalarials for malaria. So do a malaria RDT, a rapid diagnostic test, show that you're positive, and a pharmacy will dispense you antimalarials. Malaria continues to kill people, many, many people globally. And it's this, how do we inject AI really usefully into the workflow without thinking about how we need to replace someone, but rather just make it easier for someone to read a test? Because that red line can be pretty faint sometimes. So that the right person can get the right drug at the right time.
That makes so much sense, and we will definitely come back to LLMs. But one, I guess, like if I go one level up, I think one of the things that I like about the approach or the way you talk about this is that you frame this as the task to be done. I guess it's taking in the nuance. There's many tasks that people have to do. You can think about that for a patient. You could think about that for a community health worker or any type of healthcare professional. And then thinking about where the value adds are for this type of for a type of task, rather than maybe shoehorning technologies into workflows, or versus rather thinking about the tasks that need to be done that could leverage automation, LLMs, other types of technologies, etc. Seems like a more valuable approach.
Absolutely. I think it's the story of your career and mine, right? The technologists realized that just having a data set wasn't enough to create a product. You really need to understand the clinical workflow and where you could have a value add. It's partnering with health workers to go, how do we make this bit of your job either easier, more effective, more efficient? It not only reduces the barriers to adoption, right? Because we're the end user in a lot of the cases. It also exposes those bits of the health system where there are opportunities for cost saving, cost effectiveness, improvements in efficiency. We talk so much about the billions we could save. I don't think that you're ever going to find that use case without speaking to one of us humble physicians.
Absolutely. Let's get into cost savings a bit.
Yeah.
Because part of it, you know, we've talked about impact. Oh, there's an impact to make a patient's life easier at the last mile. There's an impact in terms of information in enabling clinicians to make better decisions. That's a benefit and a value add. And then there's a separate overarching thing around how do you create cost savings? Sometimes they are linked to those two. Sometimes they are not. And that's also a balancing act that health systems and governments have to do. What are your thoughts about how we measure that impact in any context, but in particular in low and middle income country settings?
Oh, what a great question. And it opens up a real can of worms for me, because I've had a gripe for a long time with the fact that most of the research that comes out fixates in terms of impact on accuracy, right? So, we've got superhuman accuracy when 99% effective on diagnosing X on an X-ray. And there's a wonderful paper back from a group at Stanford, so John Ioannidis' group. If anyone wants to look it up, it's Siontis, Siontis et al. From 2015, where they really clearly demonstrate there is no link between when you're comparing diagnostic tests head-to-head in an RCT, how much better the diagnostic test is and the downstream benefit to a patient. So you can have a massive performance gain on a diagnostic test and no benefit. You can have a tiny gain in diagnostic accuracy and a huge benefit. And it's intuitive, right? The healthcare system is this complex ecosystem. And diagnosis is a small bit of the clinical workflow, right? It's making sure the right patient shows up and asks the question that prompts that diagnostic test. It's about having the therapies needed to do something about it, right? We've for a long time struggled with whether we should be doing diagnostic tests for Huntington's disease, right? Because it's a genetic disorder for which we have no treatments right now. And so some people want the test because they want it. It's patient choice. Great. Let's enfranchise that right. A lot of people don't, because there's nothing we can do, right? One extreme
Absolutely.
Example.
Yeah.
In terms of impact, in terms of cost effectiveness, there's just not enough studies, right? I know of one RCT that was funded by my colleagues at the Wellcome Trust in the world. In terms of world of funders, there's one RCT in Africa that I know of that actually looked at the cost effectiveness of an AI tool that was published. Dr. McPherson from the Malawi Liverpool Wellcome. It's a TB chest X-ray computer-aided diagnostic tool. And it's actually opportunistic screening of people that are coming to an HIV clinic. And at most cost effectiveness thresholds, it's actually not cost effective, which is a little bit of a disappointing result. But they use much lower thresholds than we would use in the UK. And that's all to say that you get these wonderful high-level papers from the consultancies saying that we're going to save 100 plus billion from the introduction of AI into the healthcare system. Show me the proof. Like, show me the individual use case where there's the proof. I'm still waiting for it.
Do you think that we should be thinking beyond cost effectiveness? and other measures of value and impact. Because just to touch on something you said, we're evolving from thinking only about performance to thinking about value. And I guess my soapbox is value isn't just cost effectiveness and saving money. There's other bits of value that we talked about. And sometimes one bit of value, which is saving money, is directly in conflict with another bit of value, which is giving someone a smooth experience or reaching the last mile of healthcare, for example. They might be at actual direct conflict with each other. How do you balance that? How do you help governments think about that in Digital Square?
No, you're absolutely right. And we spend a lot of our time trying to convince governments to think about improvements in human morbidity and mortality as the primary outcome they should care about, right? It's about making human lives healthier. The weird thing is that most of the efficiency gains that we get, what I have been referring to as non-cash releasing efficiency gains. If you make a doctor more efficient, you don't pay them for fewer hours of work. They still work 9 hours. They just see more patients, right? So we've helped improve the lives of more people. We haven't released any money from the system. The government hasn't gone, oh, I'm paying less to see the same number of people. I am seeing more people, which is great. But it's really hard for them to then document the win, which is where I completely take your point. We need to help them see the value in improving people's lives. It often comes back to money. Maybe not money that they have in their pockets, but the money that they get from making that person's life better.
I 100% agree with you. And like, it's not to say that we shouldn't be thinking about cost effectiveness. It's just thinking broader. Like, what are the second and third order effects of that, right? So what does that enable? What does that save money enable? It enables better use of resources or continuity of care or more healthcare workers. It enables time saved, enables connection to a person. So it's thinking beyond like cold hard numbers and thinking about the actual real value that they enable. So that's a good one to think about, and thanks for framing it particularly within this context. What opportunities do you think still could be explored? Where do we need to focus? Where does work need to be done? So that people who are kind of really trying to create impact in this area can really hone in on them.
I'll go one upstream, one downstream, right? The upstream is we need to focus on strengthening the data science ecosystems in the low and middle income countries, in the communities that we're talking about. A lot of the products that are being developed by people in high income global north countries or in like the technical powerhouses that are India and China, and they're being exported, right? It's not to say that the products are bad, but we will never understand to the same extent that someone living in that community who is experiencing these problems, how best to solve the problem, right? What are the hurdles they need to navigate? It's their lived experience that really needs to be captured. And there's two ways to capture that lived experience. Either you can meaningfully involve them in the product development, which I think is the basic thing we should be doing. But ideally, if we strengthen the ecosystems in the countries that are experiencing the problems we're trying to address, they can become the agents of change themselves. And that's a lot of what Digital Square focuses on doing. We call it our localization agenda. We're increasingly hearing about localization from our donors as well, which we're super excited about. But it's investment in the local innovators and entrepreneurs so they can be leading the way on the next generation of AI-based technologies, digital health innovations that we're going to see. So that's the upstream bit. The downstream bit is there is no point us investing in all of this research if we're not going to invest in the enabling environment that gets that research and product to the bedside. There is this really unsexy thing that no one likes to talk about that is regulation, right? Regulation exists to safeguard the population, to put up the right guardrails to make sure the right technology is making it to the bedside. Given how disruptive these technologies are, there are huge questions around whether the current state of regulation is sufficient. And that really ends up with two things happening. Either you have regulators going, it's probably not sufficient, we don't know what to do about it, so none of you get to do anything, right? And we're just going to put up this massive hurdle that says, nope, not until we figure this out. And the state at which the bureaucratic process moves, it'll be years before we figure this out and you can do anything about it. Or you get the Wild West, right, where regulators are kind of turning a blind eye, everyone's doing what they want, and we are definitely exposing people to things that aren't safe or effective And I'm not sure how comfortable I am with either.
Yeah. Do you think there's a middle way?
Do I think there's a middle way? There must be, right? Otherwise, I wouldn't get up in the morning and do my job. And I think the middle way is helping create these safe environments for us to test the innovative thing, but with additional safeguards while we understand what the guardrails for everyone need to be. So you hear this term sandbox a lot. Mm-hmm. Like my dream is, can we start supporting a series of AI as a medical device and large language models as a medical device sandboxes, not just in the UK, where you have things like the government announced an airlock, which is their sandbox that they'll be running over the next couple of years, but across Africa, across Asia, across Latin America and the Caribbean. Like I said, I think I'm a broken record at this point. If we're going to solve the issue of health equity globally, we can't be running these sandboxes just in the UK.
I really like that. And in particular, it comes to the why of this podcast series as well. Our gaze in digital health is often very focused, at least in my bubble, on the EU, in the UK, and the US. And I think this plays out in the regulatory sphere as well. So our regulatory gaze is very FDA focused. Mm. It's very, I mean, even if you look at the members of the IMDRF, the International Medical Regulator Forum, it's very, very heavy on like high income countries. There are a few represented. You mentioned South Africa when we were talking before, I think. I think we need stronger voices and representation from other contexts. Mm-hmm. And earlier you mentioned localization in the context of like the actual deployment. I think this plays out in regulation as well. So how do you get it right between, okay, you need a body creating core international types of standards. Mm-hmm. But as you've alluded to, there is a need for local context nuance. The needs or the regulatory needs or the way it shapes out or plays out in a local context might be very different. I'll give you an example. Some people think, well, actually, when we think about regulation, we're thinking about benefit versus risk, right? Do your benefits outweigh the risks? That's like the kind of, I guess, like a central tenet of what it's trying to do. And sometimes when you're thinking about certain contexts, some people are proponents of saying, well, in this low resource setting, the risk of not applying this technology outweighs the risk of like taking ages to get regulatory approval and kind of have something there. How do you see this kind of local needs? And this is a local need, like we really need something here now, right? Versus we need to do this in the right way. We need to think about this in a safe way, protect people, especially people who are more vulnerable and underserved. How do you think about this? How do you help governments think about this? How should innovators in the audience who are listening to this think about this?
What a great question. And so many pieces to it. So I'll work backwards. I think it's that bit about vulnerability that always sticks in my mind when I hear the argument that there is this urgency that we need to respond to. That means that we should, for a moment, disregard the normal rules and procedures and just get on with it, right? Because there is such an outsized benefit. And it's, I think, a little bit bizarre this coming from me, someone who has an academic post in AI for healthcare, someone who has worked in the field, who really does believe it can be helpful. I think sometimes we assume that what these tools are going to do is going to be so profound that we've found the equivalent of a parachute, right? Nothing is a parachute. It is not the difference between zero people surviving and almost everyone surviving if you jump out of a plane. These things are incrementally beneficial. And yes, that increment will be a lot larger when you're supporting a community health worker, a trained nurse in rural Congo than it will be in central London. But I am not a huge fan of moral relativism. And I think that there are safe ways for us to trial these procedures, figure out what does meet the threshold that we all know to be appropriate so that we can get it out at national scale, rather than just trialing it on people that I don't think are necessarily being given a choice. Because when a community health worker shows up with a tablet and is collecting information and is generating a prediction, are we sure that there is meaningful consent being considered here? When you're talking to a person who sometimes doesn't even have a primary school education, let alone a secondary or tertiary education. So like, I think there are nuances that make me maybe a bit more worried than others about how quickly we deploy this technology. So I think that's the thing that I really want to, I wanted to say as we think about how quickly we want to deploy these technologies globally.
Yeah.
On the other piece, on the regulation, I think you made a great point. There's a role for harmonization, but there is also a pretty key aspect of localization here. And there are groups like IMDRF, like WHO, that play a key part in making sure we get the harmonization right. But, and the analogy I like to use is, these technologies are very different to the pharmaceuticals that we've thought about for a long time. So when you give someone paracetamol in London versus when you give someone paracetamol in Cape Town in South Africa, pretty likely they're going to respond the same way. It's because human biology, highly conserved, right? You'll have seen the jokes that, like, we share 95% of our genetics with a banana. Biology is just highly conserved. And there are now increasingly a recognition that you do get genetic differences, but not to the same degree that you see with software and AI as a medical device. These technologies are inductive. They're based on the data they saw. And if you train them on a white middle-class man in North London, right, it's unsurprising if you were taking pictures of that person's skin to see if they've got a cancerous mole or not, and you take it to Cape Town, South Africa, it's probably not going to work as well, right? And you need a regulator to be asking that question, to be creating the benchmark that is representative of the local population so you can evaluate its local effectiveness so that you can decide, yes, this one, no, not that one. And what we're seeing is because the technology is so innovative, because the questions around how to regulate it are so new, regulators are making really bizarre decisions, right? They're using pre-existing frameworks in a way that at times is comical, but also really worrying. So the example I'll give you is that a regulator, I shan't name which one, in Africa,
go on.
Approved a, go on. It was South Africa. Approved an AI-based tool for diagnosing TB on a chest x-ray using the in vitro devices framework, which is a different type of medical device that has a very similar kind of risk classification approach, but it's a different type of device, right? And the classification they gave it was class one, which is the lowest risk. And it's what you would give to something that is non-sterile, very low risk. So the analogy is the other thing I might give a class one approval to would be if I was bed bound in a hospital and needed to urinate, a nurse would hand me like this compostable thing that I would urinate into that would then be disposed of. So the diagnostic tool for TB that determines whether you might go on to go get the drugs that you need to treat a disease that still kills tens, if not hundreds of thousands of people a year globally versus the thing I urinate in ships. Clearly we aren't getting this right everywhere. And a lot of time needs to be spent investing in the capacity of national regulatory authorities. I'm not saying the FDA or the UK has the right answer either. I think we're all figuring it out, but we need to work together more. Sorry.
I was just going to add that you could argue that at least in the EU, in the UK context, the CE mark is similar. You kind of, if you're in the class one or the kind of lowest class of risk, you basically self-certify, right? And you say, well, I think I'm in, you know, we think we're in this type of class, et cetera, which, you know, at some point you might get called out on saying, actually, you're a bit more involved in the whole diagnostic process. So, you know, even though you say it, so there is an interesting thing there that also plays out, I think. And I wanted to touch on the thing you mentioned about taking something that's developed in one context and kind of dropping it into a task in another context. I think that at least the medical metaphor, I like using medical metaphors, but one of the ones that I would use in this context would be, you know, if I'm a GP trained in the NHS in the UK, right? And, you know, I spent some time working in Sierra Leone, or if I was going to then be working in a different context, I'd have to do a lot of work to make sure that I understood what was going on in that context. I had to get some kind of local certification that showed at least that at least in the UK context, I was up to some level of competency, and I showed that I had some understanding and some education and some work done in those contexts. And then sometimes if you're working more regularly in those contexts, you might be supervised by clinicians who are working in that context, mm-hmm. right? And so I feel like there's some equivalence there in terms of how regulators might or might not be thinking about it, of how we might be applying or approach this conversation. If you're having a doctor from one context into another, maybe in between some geographies or countries, there might be some agreement that if you reach this kind of threshold of certification, that's okay, but you would need to still do X, Y, and Z to be able to practice here. I feel like there's some kind of regulatory similarity there.
Yeah. The regulatory nerds listening to you talk about that will immediately have gone, what he's talking about is effective reliance practices, right? So the UK will sign an agreement, the MHRA will sign an agreement with the US FDA and set up a reliance practice where we think that their regulatory procedures are so robust that if they approve something, we're happy to rely on that. It kind of happens in the EU as well, that you have one stringent authority that will do the evaluation on behalf of the EMA, so all of the European countries can then use the drug. I think the point that I want to drive home is that kind of naive reliance where it's, yeah, your processes are good enough, only works in so many contexts. And given everything we've talked about, how AI and software is meaningfully different, that inductive logic-based approach, there are really smart people in the regulatory space. So Johan Ordish, who used to lead software and AI regulation at the MHRA, but has now jumped over to Roche, talks about this idea of enhanced reliance, right? So you take everything that someone else has done and gone, okay, it met the threshold. Now, what are the questions I need to ask to make sure it works in my unique context, mm-hmm. or whatever differences might exist? So the simple example might be in the US and the UK, we actually use different units when we talk about the amount of hemoglobin in blood. So some people talk about grams per liter, some people talk about nanometer. That changes how the number is structured, right? Sometimes it's 136, sometimes it's 13.6. So small quirks like that are important. Differences in how the health system is structured, right? Remember, people go to a community health worker first in a lot of countries in Africa. People go to a GP first in a lot of countries in Europe. So does the tool integrate into the health system in the same way? Mm-hmm. All of these questions about local nuances and quirks that you should be asking locally, but you can rely on a lot of the, are they ISO 13486 compliant or 62304 compliant? Like if they're compliant with the ISO standard, you don't really need to ask that question again.
Yeah, I like that. And to me, there's good takeaways for a regulatory audience, but also an innovator who's trying to create impact in that space. How do you think about this? How do you make sure that you're ready? How do you bake in and design and test and benchmark yourself for being ready for those types of deployments? So a really nice takeaway for people working in digital health companies. Okay, we've covered so much. I want to talk about LLMs though, because we said we'll come back to it, and maybe in the regulatory context, because if they're used in this way as well, they are medical devices. So what's your take on regulation of LLMs and where we're at with that?
Oh my God. It's super interesting to see how the world has diverged, right? So in the UK, you had a blog published by the MHRA where they said a lot of the LLMs that we're talking about that are accessed via an API. So think GPT-4, think the MedLM series that's released by Google, falls into this grouping of things called SOUP, software of unknown provenance. And it's quite hard to figure out how to make SOUP compliant with all of the standards that exist, which might sound like it's super nerdy and niche, but it's going to be one of the critical things that we need to figure out how to navigate if we're going to get any of this stuff through the regulatory process. So the MHRA's response was, have a go. Let's see if you can do it. Like, we're uncertain right now, but we know there are going to be key issues. The FDA is just letting everyone do everything, right? There are questions about whether they are even going to think about LLMs as medical devices or argue that it's not actually processing a signal and therefore doesn't fall within the scope of a medical device. And we've seen, 500, 600, God knows how many hundreds of AI-based tools go through FDA clearance now. So the FDA's and the US market is way ahead of the rest of us. And then you have Australia that said, hey, we're not even going to let LLMs do medical notes summarization because we've seen all this research about the fact that it hallucinates symptoms for patients in its summaries. And we know that LLMs hallucinate and confabulate. So you've got the three kind of key stringent regulatory authorities that have come up with different answers. Do I have the right one? No. But I think that where I've landed is, and credit to Jennifer, who's the CEO of the Digital Medicine Society, who's doing some work on this, I think we've realized that there are a handful of regulatory approaches. We don't know what the right one is. I think what we're pushing towards is don't pick a certain one, just pick one, right? I don't mind if your response is, hey, I don't get it, I don't understand it, I'm fearful, therefore no one does anything. What that does is it creates regulatory clarity, right? It means not in my jurisdiction, maybe mm-hmm. next door, but not in mine. Currently, what we have is the Wild West across a lot of the low and middle income countries where I spend a lot of my time working. And that lack of regulatory clarity means that people are being exposed to risk because the regulator isn't forcing people to register their medical device. I think having the safeguards is the first critical step. So my request would be, let's codify the three or four options that regulators have. Let's beg and plead that they pick one while we spend some time figuring out which one's the best.
Interesting take. Yeah.
You agree, Shubs? Do you agree?
I like your take where I don't know what the right thing is. I think I'm still navigating. And for me, it's also very, very contextual. It depends on the task. It depends where in the journey or the task for either a patient or in their patient journey or the clinician in their journey, what's being done. And therefore, I don't think it should be considered as a different thing to AI that's already being used.
Yeah.
In a way, we should be thinking about it in a similar way. It's an intervention, and we're thinking about the use case. We're thinking about the intended users. What is the task to be done? What are the risks associated? What are the potential benefits? What are we doing to mitigate them?
Yeah.
What's your quality management system to be able to make sure that you're trying to do the right thing, but are you trying to do the thing right as well, right?
Yeah.
And so applying that methodology and regulation, to me, is a vehicle that forces it's a forcing function. It's a stick. And to me also, it's also thinking about, it's valuable to approach this in the right way. So also, I guess another question to you then is like, how are governments or how could governments be enabled to think about the carrot side of things? Mm-hmm. So how do you recognize the value of an organization or a company who's invested? It's hard. Regulation is hard, and doing things the right way is much harder, and it takes longer and it's more expensive. How do you recognize, how do you get governments or health system or decision makers to inherently or realize the inherent value of someone approaching something in that way to say, hey, we'll invest in you, we'll back you guys because you are, you know, approaching this in the right way?
So I want to flip it, right? Because I'm not, I think everyone is scared of regulation, whereas I see it as this opportunity, right?
Totally.
Who is going to be the first to partner with the national government to go, hey, the easiest way, and I shouldn't say this out loud, but I'm going to, here is the easiest way for me to get rid of all of my competition, because I'm going to convince mm-hmm. you that you should regulate this technology, and I'm going to invest in going through the regulatory pathway while no one else will.
Totally.
What you're going to do at the end of this, you're going to give me regulatory approval because I'm going to find a way to effectively navigate the system and give you all the information you need. And then suddenly everyone else is on the outside and behind me, and now has to spend the next 18 months doing what I've just done. I think there's going to be a real first to market winner here. And the reason it scares me is because the companies with the resources to do this are the mega entities, the GE Healthcares, the Apples, the Google Healths.
But interestingly, they're the ones who are skirting it and trying to sometimes avoid the issue.
They're the ones with the disclaimers because, again, you're right, it's hard. And the risk that we run is, when the mega entities show up and decide they want to do it, they're going to crowd out the local innovators that don't have the capital to necessarily engage with this process in the same way.
I guess that's where you guys come in as well, enabling those guys as well.
Right? Enabling those guys, creating platforms for them so that they understand that this process isn't as scary as one might think. But you're absolutely right. that is, I think, our role to reduce the barriers to entry. But I take your point. I'm also just looking at it going, I don't understand why more people aren't excited. But maybe I'm a massive regulatory nerd.
I mean, look, I definitely agree with you in seeing the value of like leaning into it and doing it the right way. It is beneficial to it. And the idea is that you create a better product.
Yeah.
Right? And it actually has the impact that you intend out because you clearly thought of it at the beginning. Mm. And so it has a structure if applied right. But it does... It's an investment as well, right? I mean,
yeah.
I think thinking a company thinking about it and as an investment and something that gives you a differentiation, a competitive edge, is a great way for you know innovators in the audience, founders in the audience to think about this. So I like that. So definitely a good takeaway.
Well, that and it opens up access to markets in a way that I don't think that skirting the regulation does in the same way, right? So if you go through the regulatory process in the UK and then you engage with NICE and get a health technology assessment, what's the likelihood that you get a new CG, a clinical guideline based on your work? What's the likelihood that you then get onto the formulary and suddenly, because we have a national procurement system, GPs could theoretically prescribe your product? It's what Sleepio did, which is this digital therapeutic to improve the quality of sleep that went through the HTA process. Now GPs across the country can prescribe this thing, right? The profit revenue earning potential that national procurement mechanisms, if you have a single payer like the UK, and even if when you don't have a single payer, that it opens up, so cool. Like if I was an innovator, and trust me, I'm not smart enough to come up with my own idea, so it's very easy for me to say this, I would be looking at that regulatory process and seeing how it opens up these opportunities and going, how do I convince one of my investors to give me the money to do this? Because it's costly. It's going to take time. It's going to delay my go-to-market strategy by a few years. But the upside, sweet Jesus.
That sounds like a good answer to a question, which would be, what would be your one recommendation to having an impact on underserved communities to innovators? Do you have any others?
Do I have any others? I'll repeat the two that I think we've covered during this conversation. Yep. The first is... engage with clinicians, right? Engage with healthcare workers. You will understand the problems you are trying to solve in a much more profound way, and you will see solutions you wouldn't have otherwise seen. And you will learn hard lessons, like the cool data set you currently have access to is fundamentally meaningless, and that you are going to have to find a way to create a new data set that actually addresses the task. And the second piece is, as you engage with potential investors, help them understand the complexity of the problem that you are trying to solve. There is a lot of healthcare exceptionalism in the world. And I think us clinicians walk around like we're special, special snowflakes, but healthcare is sometimes different. And especially when it comes to regulation, it's different. There are safeguards and they're there for a reason. But if you can find the right investor and explain to them why you're doing what you're doing, right? Why you need to run the RCT, with cost-effectiveness outcomes so that you can engage with the national procurers so that you can get a massive government contract. The upside potential is enormous here. And it starts with convincing your investor that they're going on a long-term journey, not one in which you're going to take a product to market in the next year and earn a few bucks and then sell your product to GE.
That's so useful and lots of actionable things. Bilal, we've covered so much. We've gone on a journey to understand the work you've done with Digital Square, great examples of people creating real impact for underserved communities, the nuances and the challenges. Surprise, surprise, we got into LLMs and regulation, of course. And it's been really, really packed with insights and really, really tangible things that people can take away. So I'm really, really grateful for these. Where can people find more about the work that you are doing, Bilal, and the work that Digital Square and Path are doing?
It's very kind of you to ask, Jobs. We have a website, digitalsquare.org. Everything that we do ends up on there. We, I think, post a blog every couple of weeks, if not every week, on some different bit of our portfolio and project and what progress we're making. I occasionally go out and do stuff like this to talk to cool people like you about our work. But I think, honestly, it's not about us and Digital Square. The whole idea of the initiative is that if we're a consortium of partners, we're there to platform others, We're really here to drive investment into all of the communities that are driving change in the communities that are currently underserved, right? We want to be the impetus or the catalyst for change. I don't think we need to be the ones doing everything everywhere. So my ask would be, come talk to us, right? If you want to be part of the consortium, if you have something to share, to give, to do, let's figure out a way that we can help you.
There it is. We'll definitely put the links to Digital Square, the work, case studies, and the sources that you've curated and created. Bilal, it's been a pleasure talking to you. Thank you so much. I'm looking forward to the part two of this, by the way, where we'll be talking to one of the companies that Digital Square and Path have been working with, Odera. You mentioned them earlier. So that, you know, this conversation has been a great segue into the part two of this. So Bilal, I thank you again for your insights, and looking forward to talking to Odera as well after this.
My absolute pleasure, Shubs, and thanks for having me. Dino is brilliant, so I'm sure it'll be an amazing conversation.
Great stuff. All right. Some quick reflections from the episode we've just had with Bilal from Digital Square. Such a valuable conversation. We covered the challenges of bringing together government and health system thinking towards impact on the last mile of healthcare. What considerations do we need to make, particularly from a safety and regulatory perspective? We heard some examples of companies who are really moving the needle on some of this, and creating impact for underserved populations. We covered LLMs and the regulatory context around them, which was pretty spicy, and it was great. And so much more. Some great calls to action for innovators in terms of how to think about and approach some of these challenges in terms of data and representativeness of data, the implementation challenges, and how to really think about the impact that you have on people's lives. To me, it also highlights, a bit similar to previous episodes that we've had, that we need to think about a whole ecosystem perspective and the place we have. So if you're an innovator, what things can you be doing proactively before you deploy? How do you work with people locally? How do you work with clinicians and community health workers locally? Implementers and government level, how do you think about how you approach the relationship with innovators and developers, and the transformation and the value we want to create? And so there's lots to think about and take away to our own work. It's been a really, really great conversation. And I look forward to the part two of this, which is one of the companies that are part of the work that Digital Square have worked with. If you found this episode useful, then hit subscribe, follow us, share it with others who want to widen their perspective on digital health, so that we can together create better outcomes for all. We've got many exciting guests and conversations lined up in general. So come and join us and break your bubble and get a truly global perspective on digital health. Thank you.